Now, from Wichita's most listened to sports radio, 97.5 and 1240 KFH, this is Sports Daily with Jacob Albrock and Tommy Gester.
Well, hey there. Good morning, everybody. Glad to be with you here on Sports Daily. It is a Tuesday, and you do have Jacob Albrock and Tommy Gester, Max Power producing. Thanks for tuning in on KFH. Thanks for watching us on 12 News Connected. Also on Facebook, YouTube, X, all the different ways you take in the show. We appreciate it. Also finding us on the Odyssey app, the iHeartRadio app. We are coming at you from all different directions here on Sports Daily. We got a fun show coming up for you today. It is after what been a sort of slow offseason, certainly not slow anymore for the Kansas City Chiefs. We're going to bring in our Chiefs insider, Felix Johnson, to discuss all the different things happening as they are now in training camp. Can you believe that? Training camp's here. We're doing it. We're doing that thing. And we'll also talk about some of the other NFL storylines. Jerry Jones can't get out of his own way again, to the surprise of nobody. It's just there's stuff. There's activity out there in the NFL as we're ramping up now into that season. So we'll get to all that. The Aftershocks play tonight. Jayhawks hoop advance in the TBT tournament going on right now. We'll discuss a little bit there. And the Royals find their power for sure. They continue to find their power here in the month of July, really. It's all what's on tap for you today, brought to you by the Wichita Brewing Company with WBC Delano's debut brew, Hatfield's Mama, a German Kolsch with a clean, crisp character. It's smooth and refreshing. Make history with Hatfield's Mama, Wichita Brewing Company, Delano's debut brew. It's available at all three WBC brew pubs. Tommy, good morning. How are you?
Man, I'm here. I'm hanging in there. My allergies are acting up today. I don't know if it's the change in the weather that we saw last night, but my nose has been a faucet. My eyes watering like crazy. I've been like sneezing like crazy. Here's the thing. You know you're married when your wife gets mad at you for sneezing. Like she's like, can you sneeze a little bit quieter? And I'm like, this is just the way that I am. Like this, the way God made me. I can't change the way I sneeze, but I'm here. I'm hanging in there.
One of my favorite stand-up bits for a long time is a guy was like, people ask me what it's like to be married, and I say, you want to know what it's like to be married? Imagine being in a room and sneezing more than one time, and from the other room, somebody screaming, "Why don't you just die already?"
Understandable. I can relate to that. Relate to that big time. So that's going on. Then we had that big thunderstorm roll through last night. That was
loud. Yeah, look, it could be allergies. It could be a little cold. It's bugging through. We haven't slept in like a week. Ugh. Our son has swimmer's ear. I hope that you don't have none of your kids deal with that. It is. You want to talk? It must be the most painful thing in the world. I feel like I had it as a kid. I don't remember. But man, it kills it. It is like we finally figured out what it is. So we're trying to get under wraps. Every night we get a wake up call. That the old ear's hurting. So we're surviving. We're just a couple 40-year-old dudes, you know, just taking life's blows and waking up early and kicking right along here with it on Sports Daily.
I loaded up with the meds, by the way, last night before I went to bed. You know, I've got the Zyrtec, I've got the nasal spray, I've got all these different things, and I feel good. I'm like relaxed. I'm settled down into bed. I fall asleep. I may be asleep for 30 minutes, and then the storm rolls in, and like big clap of thunder, and I am awake, and I am just, I'm up. I mean, we're here. I'm trying to, you know, caffeinate myself to get through the next couple of hours.
Thanks to Prairie Fire Coffee for all that caffeination. An endless supply there in studio for us with the large dispenser thing that they have that brews, that's great every time I'm in there. I know you guys use it in the morning, especially when I'm in there on those long infinity shifts. I bet I have 13 cups of coffee just because it's hot and it's good on the, I'll be on Sunday morning, by the way. If you're driving around Sunday morning, you can hop on the Infinity Sports Network at 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. We'll be having some fun. We have things to talk about now, and that includes here. The Royals have found their power, Tommy, continue to find their power here in the month of July. They win 12-4 last night. Salvador Perez with a couple more home runs. You were joking with me that John Rave is leading the American League in home runs. And I'm like, that's what the craziest part about that is. And this is post All-Star break. The craziest part about that is anybody's leading Salvador Perez at this point.
Yeah, well, and that's not the case anymore. Salvi retook the lead with that home run late in the game last night. So I think it goes Salvi 1, John Rave number 2 in the American League with home runs. Like, move over Aaron Judge, move over Cal Rally. It is Salvador Perez and John Rave after the All-Star break.
And it is Jack Caglione finding his power a little bit. So in the month of July, right now, after being the very bottom end of baseball and home runs, the Royals are 8th in home runs across Major League Baseball in the month of July. This is, you know, I don't know if any of this is going to be enough. I don't know if they're going to be able to hold it together. They're back to 4.5 games back. And 6.5 games back of the Yankees. I don't know if any of it's going to be enough, but we've said it for a long time, at least I have. There is a law of averages thing that's bound to happen at some point this year with the offense. Nobody ever expected this to be one of the best offenses in baseball, but nobody expected it to be the worst offense in baseball, which essentially it was through the month of June. There is some correction coming. This may be what we're seeing now, which would be great timing, but it's coming. Salvador Perez is a better hitter, basically up and down the lineup. Everybody but Michael Garcia, you can say, oh, yeah, they're a better hitter than they've been playing. And here we go. And if it comes with power, then the Royals might have something for a little while, a little something to start building with here.
Well, as I'm watching the game last night, I mean, don't forget, they were playing at the time the team that had the best win-loss record in Major League Baseball. It's not the case anymore after the Royals won last night, but they entered that game. The Cubs were the best team in baseball from a win-loss record perspective, and the Royals were able to get it done. I think what was so important with the game last night is that, first off, Noah Cameron took one on the chin early on, but then settled in there and really, I thought, pitched well. Like, that didn't really phase him, giving up 4 runs in the second inning, 2 home runs, a solo shot from Carson Kelly, and then, you know, a 3-run bomb also. And at that point, you're like, man, it's a 4-1 deficit for the Royals in the second. We've seen this story before where that almost seems insurmountable. And then before you know it, the Royals have tied the game. Then they take the lead on some miscues from the Cubs, and the power comes alive for Kansas City as well. But I thought it was really important that Noah Cameron really kind of settled in there, and it didn't derail the entire game. He still went 6 innings, only gave up those 4 runs. And for a young guy in the rotation and a guy that hasn't really gotten run support much this season at all, yeah, he may have given up 4, but for the first time in what I can remember, maybe in his entire short major league career, he actually got run support from the offense. Like, they were able to pick him up when he didn't have his best stuff. And, you know, I thought that was pretty essential.
Yeah, we're going to dig into this on the other side. They've made up 2 games on one of the wild card teams in 2 days. This is the kind of roller coaster we were talking about. And it goes both directions, and it probably will go both directions over the next couple of weeks here until we get to that deadline of how do you navigate this if you're the Royals? And again, we've been on this for a while. The most likely scenario is you just ride it out. You just play. You know, you just go. So we'll have more on that. We've got the Memphis Tigers trying to join leagues and then not successful. And then we'll get to the latest on their try for the Big 12. That's an interesting story. It's all coming for you today. We got a lot to talk about. It's All Brock and Caster. It's Tuesday. Don't go away.
It's time to get back to the sports talk.
All right, let's do this thing. Go!
Sports Daily is on KFH.
All right, welcome back in, everybody. It is Sports Daily. One of those NFL storylines, well, two, that we'll talk to Felix Johnson about are these defensive ends here. Now we've got Trey Hendrickson, according to Ian Rappaport and the NFL Beats. He is, left the state for Bengals camp because talks for a long-term extension broke down for him. The Bengals also have one of the rookies that's not signed yet, and their owner went out and was talking about the rookie wants guaranteed money, even if he goes to jail or something. Jerry Jones is out there talking trash for some reason on Micah Parsons. Not sure why. Micah Parsons is kind of out there catching strays. Like, he wants a deal, but you're just sitting here on a Tuesday and Jerry Jones is taking shots on some radio show.
And Dak Prescott. Dak Prescott kind of got a little bit of a stray there too.
Yeah, Dak, you know, he's paid Dak. Dak can take it. But you're still trying to get this figured out with Micah Parsons. He just can't help himself. But, you know, that it shouldn't surprise anybody. We'll get the latest on those situations and these ends demanding all this money while the Chiefs get Karlaftis on a deal that feels pretty normal, feels pretty, you know, where it should be. How do they do that? We'll get into all that with Felix Johnson. Maybe we'll get into it before as we make our way through. But we're talking baseball here. Is the Royals power up last night? They are finding it right now in the month of July. And Jack Caglione is starting to hit a little bit. Salvador Perez continues to hit a lot of it, and everybody's just sort of doing the job here. Tommy, the power is something this team is not probably going to be good at in totality, be great at, but it should be better than it has been. It's been oddly bad this year. Doesn't make any sense that it's been as bad as it's been. And some of the guys that are contributing the greatest to that are heating up here. This could be a difference maker for them. And this is the kind of thing too. Like, even if they're 4.5 games back now, they've gained two games and one game. They gained one game on everybody they're chasing yesterday that currently owns a wild card spot. So that's great news. They may not, by the deadline, be a whole lot closer in the wild card race. Who knows? But even if they aren't, and the trade deadline passes, and the Royals don't do anything, and let's say they do end up trading Seth Lugo, who is cranking up everybody's list now of guys that could be traded. Even if all of those things happen, these are the trends that sort of make you think they could contend anyway, right? After the trade deadline, we're going to have 2 months of baseball to play. So that is one of the strange things about this team too. We've only seen them get hot really one time this year, and they're a better team than that. So maybe it just happens late, and that's fine too.
Yeah, I think the answer to what direction the Royals go, it lies in that conversation of the pendulum swinging so wildly back and forth between them being buyers and being sellers. It's in the middle, and really, I think that's been hidden in plain sight this entire time. And I'll admit, like, I get caught up from game to game or series to series on saying things like, oh man, they need to be sellers. Like, it's not going to happen for them. Get rid of everybody, get value in return. And then they win a couple of games, or like last night, the power shows up for the Royals. And I'm like, man, like, it's right there. They can make the playoffs. Like, let's get some reinforcements in here. So I think it lies somewhere in the middle where, honestly, this team, the way it's constructed right now, it could be a postseason team. Like, they've got the talent to be a playoff caliber team, but we haven't seen the consistency. That's been the number one issue throughout this entire year. We've not seen the consistency offensively, at least, for them to be able to show that they are a playoff caliber team. It really starts and ends with Salvador Perez. He's the captain for a reason. And where he goes, this team goes, honestly, because he's been, I think, and everybody knows this, like, he is the emotional leader of this ball club. And when he's down, the team is down. When he's pressing, the team is pressing. I think those youngsters, and even a guy like Bobby Witt Jr., who is a superstar, I think in some cases maybe takes his cues from Salvi. And, you know, Salvi has not been very good, like was not very good at the very beginning of the season, really struggled. He had that stretch of baseball where, you know, he looked completely lost up there, and you're like, man, like what's going on with Salvi? Is this the start of the decline for him? And then all of a sudden, we've seen it just sort of blossom and the power come back and the offensive stats start jumping off the page at you. Since the All-Star break, by the way, Salvi is 7 for 15, 2 doubles, 4 homers, no strikeouts. And I mean, I think the no strikeouts part is incredibly telling because that was a big knock on him early this season that he was chasing pitches that typically you don't see Salvi chase. We know he has a high chase rate in general, but there were some pitches and you're like, man, Salvi, you've been doing this for too long. Why are you chasing these pitches? And the fact that he's got no strikeouts since the All-Star break tells you that he feels rested, the patience is there, and he knows the power is back.
He's a streaky hitter. I mean, he's a streaky hitter, but he's also a hitter that can streak for months at a time. He has had a really strong 3 weeks. His month of July is probably ahead of what you'd expect from him. So I don't want to put it all on Salvi, but it is right now. He's been the last guy to come along of the guys we expected to come along. And the other thing that's going to make it easier for Salvi is if Jack Caglione hits, right? If Jack Caglione, that's that opposite field home run yesterday, that's the second time in as many games, or maybe it's the last three games, that he has had a critical moment where he took the ball the other way. Now, this one left the yard. The other, I think, was just a single. But he's still, like, you can see his development coming a little bit. Now, all of a sudden, he can protect Salvi to some degree, and Salvi won't get pitched around. And I'm telling you, like, you're a big league pitcher. You watch what Cags is capable of, what looked like an innocent fly ball yesterday left the yard with that oppo power. If you know that sitting behind Salvi, you're not going to be as inclined. You still would rather pitch to Cags than Salvi, but you're not going to be as inclined to just never give Salvi anything to hit.
I hope that a light bulb went off for Jack Caglione when that home run left the ballpark last night that, oh yeah, I can do that too. Like I can take the ball the opposite way and be productive. I don't have to try to just be a straight up pull hitter because right. I'm not going to get pitches most of the time that are going to allow me to pull the baseball and hit it to right field. And so the fact that he's able to take it the opposite way, and we've seen more than one example. I mean, you mentioned that single that he had and then the home run last night. That had been a critical piece of his game at the plate that he had been lacking since being called up to the majors. If that can develop, and the fact that he can, you know, if he can then hit the ball all over the park, then that adds a different dimension. And pitchers know that, you know, or should learn that, man, you can't really take him outside either because he can go the opposite way with it.
That is one of baseball's best offenses that the Royals played last night. So, you know, no excuses for Noah Cameron, but a little more understandable where he had one of his not better starts, but it wasn't.
It was like, only the second inning. I mean, the second inning
over the pitching side,
the second inning was not good. Once he got away from the second inning, he looked right. Like Noah Cameron has looked all season long.
But in totality, that's if Noah Cameron is got ace potential, which I'm still not sure of, but if he has top of rotation, right, potential, those are what bad starts need to look like, right? You had a bad inning. Otherwise, you were really effective. He gave up too many hits, but he still struck out 7 in 6 innings, right? Like he was still effective despite it. And so, yeah, a couple long balls got him. That is a thing in his worst starts this year that have gotten him. It's being the victim of a long ball in his 3 worst starts this year. He has given up 2 home runs in each of those starts.
By the way, though, like with Cameron, and I think this is an important discussion to have. How many times do we see young pitchers in Major League Baseball that have a bad inning early on and then the wheels fall off? You know, they don't recover from it. They don't come back from it. They end up getting yanked in the third or the fourth. It snowballs for them out of control. And that didn't happen for Cameron. He gave up 4 in the second and then really settled himself back in and let his offense then go pick him up. And before you knew it, the Royals were back with the lead. The way that the Royals won that game last night, that's not the way that the Royals have won games this season. It has not been with the pitcher giving up runs early and then the offense carrying them to get the lead back. That's not been the recipe for success. But it happened, and it worked against one of the better teams in Major League Baseball. I think that there are a lot of different takeaways from that particular game that you can then carry on long-term. Going back to the lineup, I mean, are we going to see John Rave continue to hit a bunch of home runs? I mean, probably not. Like, let's be honest. But if he can be even halfway better than what the other options in left field have been, do the Royals necessarily need to go out and find a left fielder? I mean, if you've got a Nick Lofton, John Rave platoon, both of those guys offensively have been better in the month of July. And if you've got both of them producing at least somewhat in left field, at that point, do you feel like you need to go and trade for a left fielder and another bat in the lineup? I don't know. I mean, that's up to J.J. Piccolo. But it certainly is encouraging to see the current guys at the bottom of that order be able to produce.
Yeah, look, they're not going to make a trade for a bat, I don't think, unless it's somebody that has control beyond this year. It's just, it doesn't make sense at this point. You're 4.5 games back in a race of 8 teams. Like, you don't need, if it's, now look, if they go get a bat that they can control for a while, Duran keeps getting mentioned, not because the Red Sox aren't good, but because they kind of have 4 outfielders right now. That's a different scenario. That's a player you've targeted to help you long term, not just this year. But yeah, you're going to ride it out with these guys, and I'm fine with it. Look, I say this all the time. The Royals, you know, everybody on the planet that watches baseball knows the Royals need offense. But if you really look within the Royals needing offense, there's only one spot on the field where you would replace the player they currently have. That is not a terrible situation, right, for an offense. There are teams that have tons of replacement players. But right now, you're most likely not removing Kyle Isbell, and I agree with that. So it's only left field. You're not putting anybody else out there besides Cags. You don't have room for an infielder right now. Like, that's the only place, really. So if we go through the rest of the season and you said, boy, the Royals have one hole in their lineup, like, okay, fine. Like, who cares, right? Again, and I've said this forever, The greatest improvement for the Royals comes internally. It comes because the guys they already have do more of what we expect them to do. It's not going to change. If they can go find a left fielder that helps them for the next 2-3 years, great. Go for it. I think that's a smart thing to do. But as it currently stands, they don't have a lot of room for change. So this ride it out is fine. Like, they can just sit here, and it's okay. If they do nothing, it's okay, because they're going to be in the mix the rest of the way, most likely, and see if they can take a shot at it. Noah Cameron, back on him. What's impressed me the most about Noah Cameron is, and what makes me think this is all real for him, is if it's not these home runs, teams don't really score on him. Like, that's pretty much the only way teams are scoring on him, is by hitting home runs. And he's going to pitch half his games at Kauffman Stadium. So that, like, there are little things like that are advantages to him, and whatever reason that is that's happening, like that's the way teams attack him, they're going to do less of it at Kauffman. So, you know, in half of his starts, he's already at an inherent advantage because they're not hitting him a ton. They're just hitting him hard when they hit him. Great. That again, I never knew when this all started if he was going to be the real deal. I thought last night, and I know he gave up 4 runs, but man, I just thought it was impressive on a day where you really needed your back into your bullpen to be able to catch a breath. He, like, gave up the runs and then jumped back right into it and said, "Nope, like, we're gonna get right back on track here and do what we're supposed to do today."
Yeah, keep an eye on tonight's game. Keep an eye on the way that 78-year-old Rich Hill pitches for the Royals.
The oldest pitcher for them ever, right?
I know, yeah. And Matt Quatrero confirmed he's not 78, he's 45, but still, he's older than you and me. That doesn't happen a whole lot in Major League Baseball these days. But Matt Quatrero confirmed he would be starting tonight. Keep an eye on how he does. And I hadn't really been following what Hill was doing in AAA up until maybe a week ago. Apparently, he's been pretty lights out in AAA for the Storm Chasers. If he can come in and be productive, and if it looks like he's got longevity on this big league roster long term, at least for the rest of this season, does that sort of draw some conclusions on what the direction might be with Seth Lugo? And I'm not comparing. I'm not comparing Rich Hill to Seth Lugo whatsoever. No. But at least having another replacement option in there, if you do move Seth Lugo, and you've also got guys that are on the shelf like Lorenzen and Reagans, to have another starter in that rotation to help pick up the slack while those guys get healthy. If Hill can pitch and be effective, then I think that also does maybe point to a little bit more of an idea that they could move Seth Lugo.
The Hill, and especially the Keuchel signing later, I mean, to me, those have screamed from the beginning, depth if they trade a starter, right? Depth if they trade Lugo. And it's not just Lugo, by the way. Chris Bubich would be the most valuable player on the market if the Royals decided to trade him. He's got a year of control, and he's a lefty. So if they ever made that call instead of Lugo, now you're talking about probably the biggest piece that'll be out there, because you've got the control and the fact that, and I don't think that's, I love that Bubich is a homegrown player. I don't think that's crazy either. Like if the Royals somehow made this decision to trade Bubich because he is maximum value right now, Bubich will likely be more expensive in 2 years than Lugo would be. And so, you know, if you don't envision being able to, you know, pay a starting pitcher $25 to $30 million a year, that may be where Bubich is by the time he's a free agent. He's going to bring a bigger return than Lugo. So if the, you know, I think his name has been floated out there, and it's always less likely because people know that he can help the Royals next year, and that's totally great too.
And then you're probably somehow, you're staring in the face not having either Lugo or Bubich next season, because Lugo will probably decline the player option.
So what I'm saying is, though, if you decided, like, if in, and they may not have enough time to do this, but if you decided, let's trade Bubich, he's the higher valued player, and at the same time work on or finish up as some sort of extension for Lugo, because you've got to think about the money you're going to have to pay Bubich in 2 years. If you can use that elsewhere, but you know, you've got Noah Cameron now, you've got Cole Reagans coming back, you've still got Waka for a little bit. Like, they still have the foundation of a good rotation if they decided to do either one. I don't think they could do both or should do both, but I think they could do one of them. And I think it could help them find the bat potentially that they'll need big picture. Even though I think it's not that, you know, them trading for a bat isn't going to make the difference of their season to me.
Keep in mind, though, too, I mean, Chris Bubich is 8 years younger than Seth Lugo.
He's a more valuable asset, valuable return. You just have to project if you think you're going to be able to pay him in 2 years.
Yeah, Jeff Passan is releasing, I think, daily percentages of different top trade candidates and the likelihood of them getting moved. As of yesterday, Seth Lugo was 80%. Right. Which was the highest I had seen it, I think, throughout this entire time. 80% likelihood that he's going to be moved by Kansas City. I think Chris Bubich was at like 15%.
So Cole Reagans is signed up. He won't be a free agent until 2029. Obviously, Noah Cameron's not going anywhere for a long time. Seth Lugo is possibly gone. We'll see what happens there. But Bubich is a free agent, I think, quicker than most people realize. So you've got to think, if you entertain a Bubich trade and you're the Royals, I would think it would be with the idea that you could somehow get Lugo to come back. And if that was the case, I could endorse that, because I mean, Bubich would bring a haul that you could justify the trade. I would think the way he's pitching, the fact that he's a lefty, the fact that he has another year of control. I don't know. I know Lugo is likely, more likely. I'm starting to sour a little bit on what that return would be. And think, like, if you might be better off just keeping him, trying to make a run and getting your compensation through the draft back for him. Maybe not. Maybe a team gets desperate and is willing. We just don't see it a lot anymore on rental type players. And if that happens, then I think you take the calls on Bubich, because if you can get a top-end prospect that helps you long-term, or a top-end player that helps you long-term, That's where I think you start to think if you're in this purgatory of the Royals, I think you've got to be thinking that way. The rental portion of the Royals is out of the question for an addition, but it's not out of the question to go make an addition because it helps you for a lot of years. They're going to need a left fielder next year too.
Yeah, and don't forget too that all the Royals have to do with Seth Lugo is make a qualifying offer to him, and then if he walks, they get a compensatory pick.
And they'll make a qualifying offer.
And they'll make it. They for sure will make a qualifying offer to him. But if they don't move him, it's not like he'll walk away and the Royals will get nothing in return for him. No kind of value back for him if Lugo ends up walking away. The interesting thing about Chris Bubich that I think is being missed and nobody's really talking about with him is, do the Royals believe that Chris Bubich is a perennial all-star? Do they feel like he will continue to be a great pitcher in the big leagues for a long time to come? This was unexpected for him this season. Like, nobody felt like, I think everybody knew that he was going to be an asset for the team in some capacity because he was really good in the bullpen down the stretch when he came back from Tommy John. But I'm not sure that anybody really thought that he would come in and be consistently the best pitcher in that rotation the entire season. Obviously, he became an all-star. Do the Royals believe that that value will continue? And if they don't think that he's a perennial all-star, then maybe it's worth trying to get as much value as you can out of him right now than keeping him on your team and knowing that in future years, you're not going to get as big of a haul back for him. Now, if they feel like he's going to continue to be, you know, a big-time star, then maybe the urgency is not quite there to move him right this second. But that's one thing that I don't think is being discussed a whole lot is that, is this a flash in the pan, a one-year thing for Chris Bubich, or will he continue to be this effective in seasons to come?
I think the answer is probably somewhere in between, but it certainly could be that he's this effective. I think, that's maybe more likely than being bad, I would think. Seth Lugo has been doing this now for a long time. Like, he's been effective. He's basically been the same player, which is a really good starting pitcher, since he's been turned into a starting pitcher.
Yeah, I'm talking about Bubich. I'm talking about Bubich.
No, I know. Yeah. I'm trying to compare the two of them.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Seth Lugo, you have this long track record of trust. Bubich, you don't as much. But Bubich was okay before he got hurt, right? But remember how effective he was last year out of the pen, too. Like, he's found something. He's just doing it now as a starter instead of a reliever. He would have more trade value. He would have to. He's got the extra year of control. He's younger. He's all these things. He's a lefty that could be a young pitcher potentially for some teams that really like to have left-handed pitching. You go and you look at contracts across baseball right now for these starters, and just the ones that recently signed. Max Fried comes to mind. Was a free agent signing this year. Blake Snell comes to mind. Free agent signing. You know what Sean Manaea got paid this year, Tommy, as a free agent?
3 years, 75 million. Okay, so 25 a year. Holy cow.
He and Nathan Eovaldi essentially got the same deal. Now, they're more in Lugo's age range. So Lugo's probably commanding that, right? Lugo's probably commanding more of a 3-year, $75 million deal. Signing him to what those other two got makes a ton of sense. Bubich will be 29 when he's a free agent. So probably more like the contract, I would say, Carlos Rodon is under, like a 6-year deal. He's making $27 million a year. You can go to Robbie Ray, got a deal this offseason at 5 years, $23 million. I would think that Bubich would get probably a little bit more than that. But just looking at guys that are around that same age and when they got deals, Severino got 22-3. So I think Bubich is going to be in a different stratosphere as far as total money. They'll probably get similar money onto what it's going to be per year. The difference, I think, will be that Lugo's gets like a 3-year deal and Bubich probably gets like a 6-year deal. And I think when you're the Royals, that's where you have to start really thinking down the road. At some point, they're going to want to lock up Vinny Pasquantino. They have Bobby Witt Jr. locked up. At some point, they're going to have to think about Mikel Garcia. At some point, they're going to have to think about Jack Caglione. That one's way down the road. But, you know, if they wanted to, if he turns out to be the real deal and they want to end up doing something like they did with Bobby Witt Jr. to a lesser degree, like you think about those things when you have pitching depth, and the Royals have pitching depth right now in the rotation. It's going to start with, it took me a long time to get to this point. The key probably to all of this is what is going on with Cole Ragans, because you always envision Cole Ragans. Everybody does. Everybody has. Cole Ragans is projected as the ace of this staff. He's been hurt all year, basically. So if you assume everything is fine with him, he's the guy that's going to carry your banner. And now you didn't know this, but there's Noah Cameron right there with him that you can build a rotation around.
I think ideally, in an ideal world, and it's unlikely this would happen, but in an ideal world, the Royals are able to sign Seth Lugo to a 2-year deal. He's going to want 3. So like I said, this is unlikely.
That's the standard.
But they sign him to it if he's able to do a 2-year deal, and then that money comes off the books when Chris Bubich is ready for a new contract. And then you can kind of roll the money that you're paying Seth Lugo, who by that time will be, 38 or 39, into a new deal for Chris Bubich. That would be ideal for the Royals. Lugo's going to want 3 years, I would imagine. And there are going to be teams out there that are going to be willing to give him that 3rd year. Regardless if we're talking about $25 million a year, $27 million a year, whatever that is, there are going to be teams that are going to be willing to give him 3 years. So again, I think that's really unlikely. But for the Royals, it's too bad that it couldn't time out that way, to where you've got the money from the Lugo new deal potentially rolling into what a new deal might look like for Chris Bubich.
Yeah, it almost can't be both. So trade one of them and deal with the rest. I mean, maybe there is
you don't do anything with either one of them this year. You let it ride out for the remainder of this year. You make a qualifying offer to Seth Lugo to get that draft pick in return if he walks, and then you deal with Chris Bubich next year when that contract is almost going to be up.
And I will tell you that if that is the outcome, and it's probably 50-50 that it is, I'm fine with it, because again, I think this team is worth giving the shot to figure it out and make the playoffs. I do. I know they're out there. Their chances are so small right now. I want to say people are, it's like the percentages or the computers give them like a 0.1% chance. But they are as talented as any team that they're competing with for these wild card spots. They have as deep or deeper a starting rotation than any of them, especially with Reagan's back. And they have a lineup that we're seeing now, when it does what it's supposed to do, is at least league average, if not a little bit above league average. Could be, but it just hasn't been this year. So I'm fine with it if that's the way they go. But if they want to play a little chess at the moment, then I'm fine with that too, because they're trying to build a new ballpark. They have a foundation. They're doing good things, right? They're making sound decisions holistically. So just things to think about at this trade deadline. They have different ways they can go on the offensive and trade away, but still be making moves that make sense long term. It's hard to imagine them having both Seth Lugo and Chris Bubich beyond next year, really beyond this year. So, you know, if they decide to make a move because of that, while they're not like in the thick of things totally, then that's fine too. They're both fine outcomes, and JJ Piccolo's made a lot of good decisions, and we'll see what he does. The other thing to think about with the Royals, they have been very, very good. Their superpower right now has been finding starting pitching in places where you didn't know it existed. Finding Waka and Lugo 2 years ago, finding Rich Hill, potentially. We'll see how he does tonight. But the way he's been pitching, like, this is their superpower right now, is finding guys on the, not on the scrap heap, but going and, you know, a little under the radar and evaluating and identifying them and bringing them in and watching them be effective. They've been really good at it.
I mean, what do you think the realistic expectation is for a guy like Rich Hill tonight, who's 45 years old?
Give you four innings and keep you in the game. That's my expectation. I haven't looked at his game logs of how deep he's going into starts in the minor leagues, but keep it competitive for four innings, and I'd be good with that for Rich Hill. I mean, he's just stopgapping until Lorenzen gets over whatever it is that's ailing him. But I'm glad they have him. Don't you feel better? I know he's 45 or whatever, but don't you feel better about Rich Hill than a bullpen game at this point? I do.
I would. I mean, and knowing that you've got Daniel Lynch on the shelf currently, I mean, he'd be the guy that would be kind of that stopgap, you know, short term. You don't have him right now. And so you don't have a spot starter on that pitching staff that you can lean on and go to when you need somebody. I mean, it was telegraphed. Obviously, the Royals had named their starter and Rich Hill had been doing pretty well in AAA. So, you know, we'll see if he's got enough gas left in the tank to be able to stay a part of that pitching staff throughout the remainder of this season. But, yeah, I mean, look, like, he's got the experience. He's just got to keep the Royals in the game tonight.
Yeah. And they'll take their swing. The Cubs can listen. The Cubs are one of the best offenses in baseball. And I'm sure Rich Hill has pitched in Chicago at Wrigley at some point, or lots of points over his career. So he'll be familiar enough with it, but find the power. It's, you know, it's Wrigley. You can hit some home runs there. Go do it again and give yourself a chance that way. That game will be tonight. Maybe more on that in the second hour, as we've talked a lot of Royals this hour. When we come back, let's talk about the Memphis Tigers. Proud members of the American, right? It's an interesting spin, but we'll get into it when we return. All right, welcome back in, everybody. It is Sports Daily. It is another hour here of the show. We will get Felix Johnson in to talk about all these NFL storylines coming up in just a little bit. So be ready for that. We've got conversations about the Memphis Tigers and their efforts to join the Big 12, and some other stories around the sports world. Of course, probably a little more Royals talk. It's all What's on Tap, brought to you by Wichita Brewing Company, WCBC Delano's debut brew, Hatfield's Mama, German Kolsch with a clean, crisp character that's smooth and refreshing. Make history with Hatfield's Mama, Wichita Brewing Company, Delano's debut brew. Available at all three WBC Brew Pubs. We get you back in here. Tommy, just finding out here, Crestview Country Club is a great supporter of the show. Just finding out that the tennis team for Crestview that my wife is on is making a regional tournament in Oklahoma City. We told you about the swim team and their big success. So, and I bring this up just for people, when you give them a call and you check it out, it's great golf. Everybody knows that. But there you go. Like her tennis crew, I think she just sent us the message, made the regional tournament. So they're going to go play. And that's been one of the great hobbies for her and a lot of people, all our teammates. They're all just people that have kind of found their way back to it. So it is more than golf. It's tennis. It's swimming if your kids are into it. It's a great bar and a great restaurant too. Have you been? I know they just changed their menu. Have you been since they changed their menu?
No, I've not. But everything I've had recently has been really good.
Yeah, they just changed it. I think like in the last week, like a total menu overhaul. Looking forward to getting in there and trying that out as well. All right, Tommy, let's poke a little fun at the Memphis Tigers here. The story yesterday is that Memphis was trying to secure, and maybe did, between $200 and $250 million through sponsorship commitments as a part of a bid to join the Big 12. Memphis has been rumored to the Big 12 for a long time. Would make sense, but I think the ship has sailed. And I don't know why they were not included in the initial rounds of expansion in a school like Cincinnati or UCF was. Memphis is a good size market in a part of the country the Big 12 doesn't particularly serve. Maybe that's a part of it. They don't feel like that's a market they can really break into much with the SEC. But Memphis clearly tried hard to get in, and the Big 12 just, they don't want them. I get it, because the problem for Memphis is what, and the problem for any team doing this now, that ship sailed, because what does Memphis football add to the Big 12 is the question that you have to ask. And it's a question you very easily could have asked for a lot of teams with the last round of expansion. But now, especially, like if you are not coming in, and this is why it was an interesting play by Memphis to come in and try and like tie all these sponsorships and everything to it. But if you're not bringing significant money to the table, as far as what you add on to like a potential TV contract or something, man, what are you even doing? You know, like it just doesn't make any sense to add teams right now.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't. And, you know, I think all along, the Big 12 has really kept its eyes on the ACC and what the ACC will do after their media deal is up. And is there an opportunity for the Big 12 to get stronger through some of those schools down the road? Right now, there's really no movement in any kind of realignment or anything like that. And so I can see the Big 12, you know, getting that offer from Memphis and saying, I mean, yeah, the money's nice, I guess, but that doesn't really raise our profile at all. It doesn't really make us stronger in the whole scheme of things. It gives us an odd number of teams in our conference. We go from 16 to 17, outside of just the upfront money that you're willing to give us and the fact that you're willing to abstain from getting any kind of money distribution from the networks for a while. What's the value? What's the advantage for the Big 12 to take that? So it doesn't really surprise me one bit that the Big 12 is like, yeah, we're good for right now. We're going to stand pat. We're not going to do anything. And we're going to wait and see what happens down the road.
You have to, you have to look at what does it do long-term, right? And when they go to the table, when they go to the negotiating room, I cannot imagine Memphis drives up the value of that deal, which means that deal is watered down now by Memphis. So, you know, if you're Kansas State or you're Kansas and you're looking at this and you're like, okay, let's look at them as a potential member. This isn't even a knock on Memphis. Memphis has great programs. Memphis does a lot. They're just too late to this because if you're with ESPN, and you're laying out the path to why you think this is a great deal and why they should sign this lucrative, Memphis isn't moving the needle. And if they're not moving the needle, that means now you have to pay one more team and you make less money. It's the schools that would have to decide to take them, right? So when we have these conversations and we're having them about, let's say, Florida State or Miami or North Carolina, those are needle movers. Memphis football is not a needle mover. And the disadvantage, the reason the Big 12 would add UConn or Gonzaga or whatever, is because they're not going to take money away in the grand scheme because they don't play football. Or in UConn's case, they don't play relevant football. I don't even know how their football deal works. But those could be additions. It's not like you can just take Memphis basketball only, or maybe you can down the road. I don't know. But that's the challenge for Memphis is it's almost like now the football program is going to hold you back. And this is, you know, this is the thing that makes all of this interesting. The Big 12 can get their basketball conference better, but they're going to have to break away basketball. Now, if they do that, maybe there's room for a team like Memphis. Maybe Memphis plays football in the American and basketball. But all of this is really good news for Wichita State. Wichita State needs Memphis to be alongside them in the American.
Yeah, I'll be completely honest. I'm not a Memphis fan, but is Memphis deserving of a better conference than the American? Probably. I would say yes.
Maybe.
I would say yes, they are.
I mean, if Cincinnati is, then correct. Memphis probably is.
If UCF is, then yes. I think Houston is in a completely different tier than any of those schools I just mentioned. But, I mean, should Memphis be in a Power Four conference? Probably. But they missed the boat. They missed the boat in getting in and figuring out a way to make this happen. Now, could the Pac-12 in this new look Pac-12 try to make, you know, a play to bring in Memphis? I guess. Would that be a benefit to Memphis? Or would it be better for them to just stay with the American for now? I don't know. I guess it depends on what the cost is for them to leave the American. I did think it was funny, though, that this happened on the same day as the rebrand for the American. And so you've got all of the member schools for the American tweeting out, like, we're stronger together. And I'm like, Memphis did the same thing. And you're like, yeah, but you won out. You don't want to. It's very clear and very public that you don't want to be in this conference anymore.
I mean, there's no risk to Memphis. What's the American going to do? Oh, you want out right. So bad, we'll let you out. No. They're like, hey, we love you, Memphis. We're right here for you. No, they need Memphis. The American needs Memphis. They again, I tell people all the time, like, when Wichita State made the move, and you were talking about UConn and Houston and Cincinnati and Memphis, what a great couple of years that was. A great league. Great league. Those that was it was a blast. And it just, you know, it just didn't hold.
But you
and
know what? I do also think, it, to your point, when you bring up Wichita State, this bears watching in the years to come as far as how it impacts Wichita State. Because you, if Memphis ultimately leaves at some point, if they get overtures from the Pac-12 or in the next round of conference realignment, Memphis is on its way out, then at that point, it's a much, much, much weakened American Conference compared to what it was when the Shockers entered it. So it does bear watching, I would say, for long-term what ends up happening with the Tigers.
There's no question. There's no question. I think the American... The problem is this all revolves around football, and so it gets really hard to find Wichita State's place in it, but Wichita State's place in that basketball league, if Wichita State is doing what it should be doing, is probably in an elevated spot. But that's the way Memphis feels right now. I mean, if you're just talking about basketball, they feel that way right now. They're the cream of the crop in this league, and Wichita State should be and hopefully will be right back up there with them. But they should be banner carrying this league every year. I think Wichita State would have places to go if it ever got to like critical mass. But even without Memphis, Wichita State isn't that unaligned with teams in the American. I mean, it wouldn't be the worst. It would just, I mean, it's a one bid league anyway, basically. So I don't even know how much would change right now if something like that happened. But I hope it doesn't. I hope Memphis stays in the American. I hope the American at some point when craziness happens, I think one more time, maybe they can get stronger. Maybe they can add teams, right? If the ACC ultimately goes away and that's the way this goes, there are probably going to be a handful of teams that would add to the league. And the American's been historically aggressive. So, you know, we'll see. But that story was out there, obviously has an impact on Wichita State. When we come back, let's talk some football. Felix Johnson's coming in. And we got a lot to get to with Felix, both with the Chiefs and around the league. That's next on Sports Day.
Okay, take it easy. We're going on the air.
This is Sports Daily on KFH. And now, digging deeper with the teams you follow, it's another Sports Daily Insider interview on KFH.
All right, welcome back in, everybody. We are joined now by Felix Johnson. You'll find him at Felix R. Johnson on X, writing for Arrowhead Addict, putting out content for a lot of different places. And here we go, Felix, because it has been, let's start with the Chiefs. You are our Chiefs insider first. It's been eventful between Rashee Rice and George Karlaftis and Trey Smith. And, you know, this slow off season has sped up to a fever pitch here. Juwan Taylor's injured. Where do you even begin? I think you begin with Rashee Rice. How much do you think, well, I guess first things first, how many games do you think he's going to get? I saw reports of 2 to 4. I don't think, I think it's going to be more than that. I think it'll be 6, probably, maybe, whatever it ends up being. But what do you think the game total is? And is this weirdly the best timing for the Chiefs as he continues to come back from that injury?
And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. I think that that could be the case where, like, if he, and it does seem like Rashee Rice is ahead of schedule or right on schedule with his knee rehab. So that doesn't seem to be a problem. So, like, this would be something like a setback that might be a small blessing if you thought about it like that. But like you're saying, I don't think it's going to be between 2 and 4. I think it's more likely between 4 and 6, probably that first month of the season or so, which does suck for Kansas City because that's probably the hardest part of their schedule. They have to start the season in Brazil against the Chargers. They have week 2 against the Eagles, and it just goes on like that just because it's the Kansas City Chiefs, and they already have the target on their back after these last few years just because they are who they are. So it does suck, and when you think about it from a football perspective, it's we're expecting the light show to return immediately, and it still has a chance to be there just because Xavier Worthy is in his second year. You have Hollywood Brown coming back from his injury last year, and Isaiah Pacheco back from his lengthy injury last year. So you can, and Patrick Mahomes is still there, and Travis Kelce still has something left in the tank. So you expect, or it could be a lot like what it was last year. And even then, Kansas City started the season, or the last undefeated team left in the league. So it could be all of these different ranges of situations. And even after 6 games of Rashee Rice being suspended, the Chiefs might be 4 and 2 and 5 and 1, and then getting a receiver. So you might be in a good situation with that. But obviously, if he's going to get the punishment deserved and probably more.
Since the last time we talked to you last week, Felix, the Chiefs have given out 2 big extensions. Trey Smith, obviously, got the deal done right before the deadline with the Chiefs last week. And then we find out George Karlaftis gets re-signed as well for Kansas City. You know, Brett Veach has always been a master at figuring out how to work around the salary restrictions and everything to get things done and to extend players that they want to see in Kansas City long term. Let's start with the Trey Smith deal. Were you surprised that they were able to get one done before the deadline? I know last week when we talked, it was kind of up in the air if they would even get it completed.
Yeah, I think I was a little shocked that it was before the deadline, and that just because we kind of talked about it, it's kind of hard to pay 4 out of your 5 offensive linemen, and none of them are your left tackle. And they had already moved off of Joe Tooney, so it was even harder to say, yeah, let's go ahead and move off of your other guard just a year later or whatever the case, a year and a half later or whatever the case may have been. So it does make sense on that front. But I think about it like, and I think we mentioned this last week when Kansas City is practicing good on good, who do they have to go up against? Chris Jones. How do you stop him? You have a really good guard or 2 guards in center, and that's what Kansas City has. And that's where the league is kind of moving in general, where the interior defensive lines are a little bit stronger. Milton Williams got a massive deal with New England this offseason. So we're seeing different things start to trend that way. So it makes sense that you would have to have a guard be paid like that. And so and obviously as an offensive lineman, you want to see an interior offensive lineman at that. You want to see guys like that get paid because that job is really hard because you're banging around a little bit more than a tackle. And obviously Trey Smith is a pancake machine. So it is impressive to see that get done. Especially we talk about Kansas City, everything that they have done and trying to continue it. This is part of continuing it because Patrick Mahomes isn't 30 yet. You got to have that protection to keep him upright for the years to come.
Okay. Speaking of protection, Felix Jones joining us, Arrowhead Addict, when we talk Chiefs, Juwan Taylor's out for a little while. We don't know how long exactly. We've talked about his role. I think sometimes we're maybe a little harsh on him. He's average. He's just expensive average. But do you think the reps gained here for the two guys we wonder about at left tackle, potentially Moore, Simmons. Could this pay off for them? And how quick a trigger, like if those two are balling out, how quick a trigger do you think the Chiefs might have to make one of them their right tackle and Juwan Taylor be a swing tackle?
It would depend on, and again, I know that this shouldn't matter to like true football fans, but like, what does that cap number look like? Because the worst thing you can be is average, expensive, and on the bench. And even like even though as important as a swing tackle position is, you shouldn't be getting paid $80 million over 5 years to do that. And you can't be doing that if you're Kansas City, and they'd probably move off of Juwan Taylor if that was the case. But we just recorded a podcast yesterday that'll be coming out next week with Nate Taylor of ESPN Now, talking all things AFC West. And he said the number one out of all of the things that we can talk about with the Kansas City Chiefs, still don't know who the left tackle is. And so, like, obviously, any type of reps at any type of tackle spot is awesome for a Jalen Moore who sat behind Trent Williams for the first 5 years of his career, whatever it was. You have a rookie in Kingsley, or a second year player in Kingsley Suamataia, who might be able to fit into a role just in case, because you never know with injuries what might be there. And then obviously Josh Simmons, he's coming off an ACL tear. Fingers are crossed all over Kansas City and everywhere else. So hopefully he can work into some reps and be consistent as often as possible. So they have a lot of options there. Even with Juwan Taylor out, it does make things a little bit more interesting. But even then, there's still plenty of question marks around the position.
With Trey Smith getting re-signed, with George Karloftis getting re-signed, that really only leaves Trent McDuffie out there right now that could potentially get an extension. Do you anticipate Brett Veach working any more magic to try to get something done?
I think it's going to be really hard. It is. They're in this weird spot between, yes, Derek Stingley just got paid. Pat Surtain has not got paid yet. Probably not going to make Pat Surtain money just because he's a defensive player of the year, best corner in the league by far.
I don't know.
But it is close. It is very, very close. But it's just kind of hard to figure out.
He'll make Sauce Gardner money.
He's going to make Sauce Gardner money. And that's where the difficulty lies. Do you kind of – it's like, does Brett Veach have any more Veach magic? Like, no, he needs some of that Howie Roseman magic, whereas, like, they just kind of pay everybody and figure it out and just say whatever. And so I don't know. That's my best guesstimation, is that I'm glad they're getting deals done sooner rather than later. It's just that they've got to get this one done before Pat Surtain, because the number's only going to increase, and then you're in a situation like Dallas is inevitably with every good player of theirs.
Yeah, speaking of Dallas, Jerry's going to talk always. For some reason, he's going to throw players he's negotiating with under the bus for no reason. Mm-hmm. But he does that with Micah Parsons. Micah Parsons doesn't like it. Of course, Micah Parsons doesn't like it. We just saw J.J. Watt get paid what he got paid.
T.J. Watt.
See Trey Hendrickson leave Cincinnati without his deal. I think we might be getting to the point. I said this yesterday. I think we might be getting to the point where these edge rushers are being overpaid. I don't know that it's worth it. Like J.J. Watt and or T.J. Miles Watt. Garrett are not. What's that?
T.J. Watt.
T.J. Watt. T.J. Watt and Miles Garrett are not going to help their respective team. They're not going to win a Super Bowl with their teams. They'll not. They're neither of those guys are winning a Super Bowl playing for the teams they're playing for during these contracts. If the Cowboys re-sign Micah Parsons, it's not going to mean they win. Like, I think the position is critical, but it's not quarterback. Like, what are we doing with some of these guys? I would trade them. And that's, again, to the Karloftis deal now looks great. It looks brilliant because it's way under what these guys are making.
I think particularly with George Karloftis, and we can revert back to this conversation, it has more similarities to do with like Garrett Wilson's deal than like any of his edge rushers, because there's and Garrett Wilson, for as good as he is, and it's probably because he's in New York, he gets a little bit more accolades or hype or whatever it is. He's probably between the 15th and 20th best receiver in the league, but he's getting $120 million because that's the price of doing business with a receiver like that. Similarly, George Karloftis gets $93 million because here, there's about 30-ish DNs. Like, Josh Sweat got a deal with the Cardinals after his performance, mostly in the Super Bowl and the postseason this year. There's about 30 to 35 defensive ends that can do what George Karloftis does. There isn't a guy like Micah Parsons. there isn't a guy like Miles Sanders. There isn't a guy like TJ Watt. Those are that's where, like, sure, your quarterback is incredibly important, and it's incredibly important to what you do. And sure, Dak Prescott is going to get paid a lot of money to do what he does, but he's not Patrick Mahomes. And so I think that's where there's always going to be a separation between the top 3 to 5 guys in the league at any position. And that's where you see a Micah Parsons, a Myles Garrett, a TJ Watt. And it's just up to Jerry Jones just isn't in the business of winning Super Bowls, because he's in the business of headlines and doing whatever. And so that's where you kind of get caught in that situation. But Micah Parsons is a critical part to winning a Super Bowl if you're the Dallas Cowboys at this current situation, because he is on your roster and he's one of the, I don't know, 10 best players in the football.
You mentioned Garrett. You mentioned Watt. You mentioned Parsons. Is Trey Hendrickson in that range as well? I mean, it sounds like there's still a pretty large disconnect between him and the Bengals over guaranteed money. He went home. He's not a part of training camp right now for the Bengals. I'm a little bit surprised that after the optimism of their owner yesterday, that they still don't have anything done.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about two of the strangest owner GM, like, and the only two owners that are GMs anymore, and Mike Brown and Jerry Jones. And so it is incredibly frustrating. And I think Trey Hendrickson probably falls closer to the George Karloftis end of things, where he's like incredibly important, but it's more that he's important to this team. And obviously he's set sack numbers and doing impressive things, but he isn't Micah Parsons. He isn't Myles Garrett. He isn't these guys. He's close. He's better than George Karloftis, so he should bridge the gap between those guys and probably get a number more similarly to Garrett Wilson. But where's the money coming from, guys? Because you just gave Jamar Chase money. You just gave T. Higgins money. We all know you don't like spending the money, and you just paid Joe Burrow however long ago you did that. So they just don't they don't know where the money's coming from. And they've already gone against what they do anyway. Trey Hendrickson is just bad timing for him mostly, but they have to get the deal done if they want to be competitive, especially in that division.
Well, that's the pressure there, and that's, I think, the difference with him. Because that's a team that you think, okay, they could win he could help them win a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. They've got Joe Burrow. They've got Jamar Chase. They've got all these people. They just have a terrible defense.
Yeah.
He's almost been twice as productive as George Karloftis since George Karloftis.
The thing is, he was on that bad defense last year, setting the sack record, or led the league in sacks last year. Your point earlier, is like, are these guys helping you win Super Bowls? Sure, kind of. Like, you can have great numbers, but at the same time, the defense was still bad because the secondary couldn't figure it out.
So trade him. Just trade him. Trade him and try to
get that, they might be in that situation because of all of the other things that they've already done. Whereas the Cowboys, they have done other things, but it only makes sense to pay Micah Parsons because he is a top 5 guy in the league at his position.
I don't think it makes sense to pay him. You paid Dak. You paid CD. If you're the Bengals, you paid Burrow.
You paid receivers. If you're Kansas City, you pay Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce, and Chris Jones.
But Karloftis isn't getting the deal these guys are getting. Karloftis falls right outside the
top. He's not as good as these guys. He's not as good as Micah Parsons.
And I agree. That's why I think his deal makes more sense. Like, I'll tell you this. I'd rather. What is his deal? I mean, I would rather spend the money they spent on him, even though he is really, not.
In the case of in the NFL, it's really hard to say you drafted a guy in the first round. He was a first team all pro for you and almost defensive player of the year in the top 3 voting for you in the first 4 years of his career, and to not give him the deal. Like, he is, like, whatever the position is, whether it's offensive line, outside linebacker, whatever it is, it's really hard to say, yeah, you drafted this guy. He is a hometown player. He is and especially for Micah Parsons, he loves being a Dallas Cowboy. And so, like, I think there is a bit.
Does he?
Of that. We think it's strange, he likes being a Dallas Cowboy. He's always showing up to stuff in the Star. And so, like, it is, you kind of have to pay Micah Parsons because he is that guy.
Would you rather pay, how old is Parsons? 24-ish?
Mm-hmm.
That's how old Karloftis. Would you rather pay Karloftis $22 million a year or Parsons $45 million a year?
Parsons $45 million a year.
That's crazy to me.
No, that's the thing. That's how big of the difference is.
But get two George Karloftises.
There aren't. You can't get two George Karloftises. You only can't. because you have to draft a Trent McDuffie. You have to do other things with your team. You have to pay Patrick Mahomes.
Let's do it. Trent McDuffie's too expensive for this example, probably. But would you rather have Parsons or Karloftis and McDuffie?
No comment. No comment. Because it's not a deal I would make, like just straight up those two guys for one. But if you're in that situation, would you rather have a top three? And like Trent McDuffie is a top five player at his position. Micah Parsons is a top three. So you're kind of splitting hairs. But I mean, yeah, I guess I'd rather have two players of those. Top 30 player as opposed to just one top three player.
I just think that position's getting overvalued a little bit. As far as not that the players aren't awesome and impactful, just as far as like being realistic with your salary cap.
Right. And we'll see. And we can get into the nitty gritty. I mean, honestly, I'd highly encourage this shameless plug here. Listen to the Let's Talk Ball podcast, especially that Defensive Trends podcast, because we talk a lot about how the cover three has returned back to the league and these hybrid players like a Micah Parsons has become more and more important. And a hybrid player like a Derwin James, a Trent McDuffie, you can play inside and out, slot corners. And so it Micah Parsons, because he is a hybrid and he is probably the best at being a hybrid, he is worth most of every dollar, and he's going to get more if Jerry Jones keeps waiting.
He's awesome. I love Micah Parsons. Mm-hmm. Don't misunderstand.
This is all Jerry's fault.
It is Jerry's fault. Yeah, he should have done this early. He should have done what the Chiefs just did with Karloftis. And mm-hmm. he should have jumped out ahead of it a little bit, and maybe he could have got him for $20 million less a year. If he would just get out of his own way.
Do his job. Just do your job, Jerry.
Just don't talk about it. Be about it. All right, Felix, what do you guys have working for us this week?
We'll be having a podcast coming out tomorrow. Let's Talk Ball once again. An episode, I think we were talking about the NFC East. Next week, we'll be talking about the AFC West, like I mentioned earlier, with Nate Taylor, now of ESPN. Had a great time with him. We were talking George Karloftis' extension. We'll have that clip coming out this week. So at Let's Talk Ball, or at Talk Ball Podcast on X, at Felix R. Johnson on X. Let's Talk Ball Podcast. That's where you can get most of my good stuff. So, yeah.
There it is. We'll continue to dig in. We'll dig into the Chiefs more and more as the weeks come and training camp rolls on. Felix, appreciate it.
Appreciate you, gentlemen.
There goes Felix Johnson. It's always these edge rushers and these wide receivers, Tommy. We don't see a lot of, you know, linebacker holdouts, do we? Quarterbacks are obviously in there too. But like where are our tight end holdouts. Like it's always the same position.
Yeah. It's the guys that are getting after the quarterback that are going to hold out, whether you're on the edge or you're a linebacker or you're a defensive lineman. If you get after the quarterback, you're the position that's most likely to hold out, I would imagine. I mean, Chris Jones did that a couple of years ago for the Chiefs.
Yeah. I get it with some of these edge rushers, Tommy, I do. But man, when you're trying to navigate and negotiate the cap, I just think there's a difference in having Micah Parsons versus George Karloftis and Joe Burrow versus I'm trying to think of a good example of a really good quarterback, but one that you don't, you know, middle of the road quarterback. I don't know what would
like
be the comparison?
Like a Brock Purdy or
sure. Brock Purdy who got it kind of a middle of the road contract.
Yeah.
There's a big difference there in what, you know, the quarterback you have to have the quarterback to win an NFL championship. There is no debate about that. Right. And the discrepancy of quarterback pay tells you that, right? How much they get paid. To think of defensive end the same way or edge rusher, to me, it just doesn't make any sense. You can win Super Bowls without a great edge rusher. Go look at the highest paid guys right now. You've got to go down to find one that's been on a Super Bowl champion recently. I don't know. Like, they're not even in the top 20 here. Who's the Eagles' highest paid edge rusher? Right? Like, it's not, it's just, it doesn't translate to me to do it that way. To pay that premium for that position does not translate to Super Bowls to me. So if I'm allocating resources and you're paying a quarterback, you've got to find other ways to put it together. And that the Chiefs have done a really good job at this. They have. But man, I don't see it with some of these contracts being given out and demanded by edge rushers.
I think that the main player right now that it does make sense to try to pay would be Trey Hendrickson. And that's only because
I agree.
He's the only halfway competent defensive player that they have on that roster. And they've got an offense that we've seen over the years be very, very successful. Now, it's not just Trey Hendrickson. They're going to have to go and get help in the secondary. And I know that they've tried to do some things to make that better this year. Time will tell if it actually will work for the Bengals or not. But they have a new defensive coordinator, all of that. You need to have your anchor defensively, and your anchor has been Trey Hendrickson. And so I would pay him. But if you compare that to the Cowboys and you compare that to Micah Parsons, it's been, by and large, the same roster for the Cowboys for the last couple of years. It's been
and
Dak.
The Bengals.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that for the Bengals, at least you know you have a highly talented offense that is already in place. The Cowboys, we don't know that yet. Like, we know who Dak Prescott is. We know that he is fine. He's not Joe Burrow. We know that he's fine. They've got CeeDee Lamb. We'll see if George Pickens can help them, whatever. But, I mean, I think anybody would take the Bengals offense over the Cowboys offense right now for sure. So I would be more inclined to pay Trey Hendrickson, knowing that at least historically he's been at least the one constant in our defense and the one guy that has been highly productive defensively for us, than giving a bunch of money to Micah Parsons when you already know that this current iteration of the Cowboys with Micah Parsons already on the defense and Dak Prescott getting paid is not going to win you a Super Bowl.
Well, I mean, look, it's probably no coincidence that these are the two highest paid quarterbacks right now, Dak Prescott and Joe Burrow in the NFL. I think you just like, it really comes down to, does Hendrickson put you over the edge? Does Parsons put you over the edge? You could switch the players and their teams. It's that you think, to me, it's that you think Joe Burrow has a puncher's chance to win a Super Bowl if you can just get him into the postseason, and having a big edge rusher is a big part of that, right? They can be game disruptors. We know that. You trust him more than you trust Dak in the postseason. So that's what it comes down to. But again, we're having the conversation about the defensive ends when it's still really a conversation about quarterbacks. And like, I don't understand why paying TJ Watt $41 million a year or Myles Garrett $40 million a year seemed like a good decision for those respective franchises.
I agree with you on that. I mean, I think that with the Myles Garrett move, the Browns would have been so much better served to take that money and spread it out elsewhere to try to rebuild their franchise.
Just trade the player and get a ton
of picks. Yeah, like I think that that's totally reasonable. And so like I don't like that signing. Kind of the same thing with TJ Watt. Like, he's a dynamic player, there's no doubt about that, but is TJ Watt single-handedly going to make you win a championship? No. But again, I go back to Trey Hendrickson. I would sign him knowing that the cupboard is pretty bare defensively for the Bengals. I would give him the money that he wants, because I think that he may be slightly less effective than those top three guys.
Yeah, people say that, but I don't even know that that's true. The numbers don't bear that out.
He may be like fourth. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he might be right behind those top three. I think the Bengals need him more to win a championship than these other teams need those other guys.
There's no question. And the Cowboys need Parsons too. And the Cowboys feel probably like the Bengals that they could. It certainly Jerry Jones does, whether he's right or he's wrong. He feels like, which is why this shouldn't have gotten to this point for either franchise in the first place. They should have been out ahead of both of these contracts so they don't have to reset the market. There's a big difference in resetting the market when it's at, you know, $30 million, $35 million, that now at probably $45 million. Max Crosby's another one getting big money like this. Ain't going to win it. Nick Bosa is probably the example of the team that's committed to the position that has the best chance. The Vikings are doing it with a couple of guys. The Bills, maybe the Bills, Greg Rousseau's making $20 million. You know, like, there's a huge difference in what these new contracts are versus what the rest of the guys, like, if, you know, it's why the Dak Prescott contract was so stupid to me at $60 million a year. Like, when, I don't know. I mean, they're all stupid on the quarterback end when you look at the list, because Trevor Lawrence right now is the fifth highest paid quarterback in football.
Yeah.
So I understand it with quarterback. There is a 0% chance you can do it with a bad quarterback. And you have a just fine chance if you have a great quarterback and a bad pass rusher. Like, you know, because that's just the way this league is. So I don't know. These debates, like, I don't get why Jerry Jones feels the need to go out there and publicly talk about it all the time and throw his guys under the bus. But I do get the resistance to pay these guys what they're probably demanding in these contracts. Because if you look at it, I just don't think it bears out to be worth it. Like, if I have a star quarterback, I'm making sure the star quarterback is paid. My second priority would be protecting the star quarterback through offensive linemen, and then I'd go from there. That's what I would do if I was a GM and I had to lay out the blueprint of, here's how I want to build this franchise. I want my star quarterback. I'm going to pay them. I want to make sure they're protected. I'm going to pay them. And then we're going to have to be a really good team at drafting, right? Brett Veach has the benefit that Patrick Mahomes is very flexible with his contract. Other guys have done that over the years. I assume guys, you know, Burrow probably will do that at some point too. But the Chiefs have been very good for the most part at identifying their guys and getting out ahead of their deals. They just don't have a lot of the highest paid XYZ. Kelsey's also been of great benefit for Brett Veach. Those two guys have been, I mean, that's a bonus most GMs don't have. They did it with Chris Jones. Chris Jones is a less expensive player than some of these other guys. So I think they do a good job of it. And that's a part of what makes him so good at what he does.
I mean, Trey Smith, they made him the highest paid, you know, guy, the highest paid guard.
But that one raised our eyebrows. But it's at a position where the highest paid guy is making half of what TJ Watt's making, basically.
Yeah. I think that, again, knowing the drama that is out there with the top edge rushers in the league, whether we're talking about Micah Parsons or Trey Hendrickson, just that drama by itself makes the George Karlaftis signing you feel that much better about. Because while he's not in the top 10, he's right outside the top 10, but at least you've got him locked in. He's a good player. You're not resetting the market with him, and there's no drama. He just reports to camp. You've got him paid. You've got him locked up, and you know you have an edge rusher for a long time to come. That has been really good for you. And you avoid all of the drama. And I think that going back to what happened a couple of years ago with Chris Jones and his holdout and everything, Brett Veach, I think, wants to do everything in his power to avoid something like that happening again, especially how it rolled over into the regular season and all of that. You know, that was a talking point and a narrative that I don't think he, you know, necessarily wants to repeat anytime soon. So, you know, getting Karlaftis locked up in the way that he did, in the manner in which he did it, the amount of money that they're paying him and all of that, and then you contrast that to the drama with the Cowboys and the Bengals right now, it just makes that contract seem that much better.
So here's another thing on this. When you look at what I'm trying to get to with this is, what does Chris Jones makes about $10 million more a year than the guys, you know, that are like the 10th highest. These contracts they're given to these edge rushers, TJ Watt, Myles Garrett, they're about 20 or more million than what their peers that are other top 10 players are making. So the comparables are there. Trey Smith is a little interesting. Trey Smith makes a lot of money compared to his peers in that top 10. So his contract will be one to watch and whether that has the ultimate value. But I just, the difference in edge rusher payments versus what good teams are paying them and what the top guys are making on not the elite teams is, to me, it's staggering. And I wouldn't do it if I were these teams. I just wouldn't do it. The Bengals are the outlier. because I do think they could win a Super Bowl if they can get Burrow into the playoffs, even with their terrible defense. I don't think the Cowboys can, although they probably feel that way about themselves. So these negotiations will be fascinating. How much pressure do they feel? I think the savvy decision is to trade the players. I do. I don't think either of them are going to get traded. They'll probably both get paid.
I bet they will. I mean, Jerry Jones is going to throw him under the bus, but then he's going to write a check. That's what's going to end up happening.
I mean, it always does. It always does. Whatever. Whatever. All right, that'll do it for us. Don't forget Royals baseball right here on KFH tonight, 7 o'clock. Royals in Chicago taking on those Cubbies. Rich Hill, the old man, can he get it done? You can tune in to 97.5 and 1240 KFH for the game. Of course, you can always listen to KFHradio.com or free on the Odyssey app. Just search KFH.
It's a busy night. We've got that going on. TBT tonight. The Aftershocks back in action. Get out to Coke Arena. Go support these guys.
And Buck.
They've got an opportunity to make a run here and should be really excited.
And some things have happened elsewhere that could bring the tournament through Wichita. There is a world where that could happen. Congrats to the Jayhawks alumni team. They're exciting. We'll recap it all tomorrow. From Action Tommy, thanks to Felix Johnson. I'm Jacob. We'll see you.